Welcome to the City Club of Eugene's March 2nd, 2018 program. Lunch with Mayor Vinas. Past success, future challenges for Eugene. This is the 22nd program in our 2017-2018 programming year. I'm Sandra Bishop, City Club President. It's a pleasure to have Mayor Vinas with us today. We look forward to hearing some of her insights into city governance and what exciting and challenging things are happening with the city these days. The City Club brings together civic-minded people to make Eugene a better place to live, work, and play. We're a member-supported nonprofit. Our members have a direct influence on public policy. To become a member, go to cityclubofeugene.org. City Club support for City Club is provided by our members and sponsors, including LULAC, the League of United Latin American Citizens, Hearing Associates, Homes for Good Housing Agency, which used to be Hacksaw, Jerry Detown, landscape architect, and one of our Sapphire sponsors, George Rohde Repair Shops, providing car care with a conscience, with three repair locations in Eugene, Euro-Asian Automotive, Stadium Automotive, and Auto House, or online at eugenerepairs.com. And a special thanks to PacInfo and Simplified Computing and KLCC Radio. City Club programs are broadcast on public radio station KLCC 89.7 at 6:30 on Mondays. The coordinator of today's program is John Belcher. Thank you to John for putting together this program. And I'll turn it over to John to introduce the mayor. Thank you. Thanks, John.
Thank you, Sandra. It's my great pleasure to welcome Mayor Lucy Vinas back to the City Club for our conversation with her. There's nothing beyond that I can share that you don't already know. So I will get off the dais, and Lucy will start that conversation and provide time for your questions. Mayor Lucy, you're on.
Thank you, John. Thank you, Sandra. Thank you, all of you, for coming this afternoon on this possibly snowy day. Year two is different from year one. If year one as mayor was like standing in front of a fire hose, as I had been warned it would be, then year two gives me the advantage of seeing the deluge coming. Year one was the learning year, understanding how to do the job of mayor and getting a handle on how the city works on a day-to-day basis. It was also a year that gave you, the public, a sense of who I am and how I do this job. As a newly elected official, I didn't step into office with a tabula rasa. In fact, I stepped into a series of policy processes that had been in motion for years. The 20-year transportation system plan, the decision about where and how to expand the urban growth boundary, and the challenge of updating our 2010 Climate and Energy Action Plan in order to meet the Council's climate recovery goals. I willingly inherited an array of roles on the Poverty and Homelessness Board, Greater Eugene and Rain Boards, the Metropolitan Policy Committee, and Lane Transit Strategic Planning Committee. In the midst of those priorities, I had campaigned on a few of my own. The challenge is to identify initiatives that will help us progress without overloading the work already underway in so many areas. I have recently given a State of the City address, and I did talk about last year's priorities and the work that I undertook last year. And so in this speech, I'm not going to cover that ground again. I will talk about the issues Council discussed in our February goal-setting sessions. In two Saturday morning sessions in February, we brainstormed and distilled the broad range of pressing issues to identify three that need more work. These priorities do not supersede other issues, but they are critical issues that call upon Council to coalesce our understanding as well as the measurements for progress. We landed on three: housing, homelessness, and public safety. First, housing. Housing is the bedrock of a community. You have all seen the data. Eugene is the second most constrained housing market in the nation. This is not sustainable. But as with most issues of this magnitude, it has been decades in the making. One of my favorite quotes from this past Monday's public forum was Deb McGee, who said, "If you do the same things, things that are the same will happen." We have to address this issue differently. We are riding a wave of public interest and concern. Language is a problem when talking about housing. I want to begin by offering some clarifications. We have housing shortages at all levels. The most severe is the least expensive end of the market. When we talk about affordable housing, historically, we are referring to subsidized housing that in our community is built by our nonprofit providers: Homes for Good, St. Vinny's, Cornerstone Community Housing, Shelter Care, and others. This housing is dependent on significant investment of federal dollars. And at this critical time of shortage, we expect those federal dollars to decrease or disappear rather than increase. When we talk about housing affordability, we are usually referring to market rate housing for people who have too much income for subsidized homes, but not enough to pay the going rate for rent or home purchase. This is also referred to as workforce housing. The constrained, expensive market puts downward pressure on tenants and buyers, each shifting downward to find housing they can afford and squeezing the lower end of the supply out of reach for the people with the least amount of money. The Council's conversation is looking at this whole range. This is where the prospect of a construction excise tax comes into play, because it offers the possibility of a new revenue stream that could help at the lower end of the market, the subsidized stock that is constructed by housing providers. At the next level up, in terms of cost, the conversation centers on the potential for missing middle housing. The new coalition, Better Housing Together, convened a forum last week that inspired a capacity crowd to share their priorities, hopes, and commitment to act in meeting our housing crisis. Better Housing Together has begun the heavy lift of bringing the disparate conversations and understandings about missing middle into focus. Council followed with a work session on Monday and then directed staff to build and refine a list of options to address the barriers to constructing this range of housing that fills the middle, spanning between single-family housing at one end and apartment buildings at the other end. This is not the same as affordable, because in our current market, this kind of housing is still expensive. That's why public investment and policies are key. Moving forward on this requires political will from Council, expertise and commitment from city staff, and engagement and support from the public. This is my job in 2018, to keep all three of those key partners moving toward progress and answers. Second, homelessness. We hear complaints that the city isn't doing anything. The fact is, the city is deeply invested in solutions to homelessness. During the winter, not counting the Egan Warming Centers, the city provides over 800 additional seasonal beds. On nights when Egan is operating, that number increases to over 1,200. Council this week directed staff to put additional funds into increasing the capacity of the dusk to dawn shelters. We have pilot projects that have developed into ongoing projects like the rest stops. Our efforts are successful. but the scale of the need outweighs the scale of our responses. While we have invested in many different kinds of solutions, we need to ask whether we are maximizing the impact of limited dollars in reaching desired outcomes. And what are those outcomes? Number of beds for emergency shelter, number of people who use the services to stabilize their lives, public perception that the situation is improving, reduced burden on volunteers. As a member of the Poverty and Homelessness Board, the city is working within the strategic framework established by that intergovernmental body. So at one level, we have already committed ourselves to those intergovernmental priorities and strategies. It is that collaboration through the Poverty and Homelessness Board that is helping us move forward on the decision-making for a permanent shelter. This is now culminating in the choice of a contractor to develop the feasibility study. News about this will be coming to you within a week or two. I expect the feasibility study to point the way to how to fund, structure, and align the new shelter with our existing services. Again, revenue is an issue. Council's concerns will span the efficacy of our efforts, clarifying our priorities and role, and hopefully highlighting our path forward. We're setting the course for the long-term continuing investment that will call upon the public for your support. Third, public safety. Key council priorities intersect at public safety. Our investment in downtown livability and prosperity, our commitment to parks and open spaces, and our community justice and investment in police services. All of these come into play in Council's decision to identify public safety as an area of focus in the coming 12 to 18 months. First, downtown. There are both perceived and real issues with safety downtown. Despite our progress last year in creating an inviting area that many enjoyed in the warm season, this winter has seen a recurrence of a transient population that makes the area feel unsafe and unwelcome to many. Council will have one or more work sessions to review the long list of strategies that have been either tried or considered before and welcome thoughts on new options. The issue relates directly to our parks and open spaces. The Parks and Recreation Levy on the May ballot includes funding for 2 Eugene police officers for the parks, including bike patrol, and 2 years of funding for the parks ambassadors who add eyes and ears and referrals in our parks. It also adds funding to respond to illicit activity, including homeless camp cleanup, graffiti removal, and vandalism. Both of these are tied to the leadership, strategies, and funding of our police department. Council received a sobering review of our existing department. In summary, the department is serving a growing population with static staffing levels, reflected in slower responses to calls for help or inability to respond at all, and an overburdened 911 center as calls stack up. On the positive side, the police have implemented 21st century strategies in which they engage longer at each incident and use de-escalation tactics that are safer and more responsive overall. That, combined with our successful community court and community outreach teams, translates into better engagement with the community. The cost is in time. Police are stretched thinner because they are spending more time on calls and diverted to a wider range of activities. Added to all of this is an increase in hate crime and worries about school safety from gun violence. The choice of a new police chief is imminent. He will come into a department that has been well assessed by our interim police director, David James. This is rightly at the top of council's list. I read an article years ago about a researcher who was reflecting on our human tendency to think that the era in which we live is the most pivotal in human history. My guess is that all of us in this room and the folks listening to this on the radio feel this way today. Which brings me to climate change. Concern about the impacts and the adaptation and mitigation they require permeate everything we do in our community. We will increasingly connect the dots. Housing, homelessness, economic development, public safety, parks and open spaces, and transportation all reverberate with the vibrations of shifting climate and demographics. There is a serious question about whether the city and the state are doing enough, fast enough, to meet these changes. And we won't succeed at all without your participation. If you think this era is pivotal, then remember that you play a pivotal part. In my second term in office, I feel the pressure of time. I have only 3 more years. The issues the council has identified, housing, homelessness, and public safety, are all long-term systemic challenges. We won't solve them in the next year, but we will take important steps. Join us in this work.
Thank you, Mayor Vinas. So now we'll take a break for about 5 minutes to formulate questions from around the tables. So when we return with audience questions, remember only City Club members are allowed to ask questions at the microphone. If you have a burning question and you're not a member, our staff is in the back to take your membership. We'll be back in 5 minutes. Thanks.
You're listening to KLCC, informing and inspiring listeners for more than a half century. Broadcasting in HD at KLCC Eugene 89.7, KLCO Newport 90.5, KLFR Reedsport 89.1, and at 88.1 KLFO Florence, KMPQ Roseburg, and KLBR Bend. You can find us online at klcc.org. KLCC is a service of Lane Community College.
Welcome back to the March 2nd, 2018 City Club program. Lunch with Mayor Vinas, past success and future challenges for Eugene. I'm Sandra Bishop, City Club President. City Club is a nonprofit organization. Support for City Club is provided by our members and sponsors, including LULAC, the League of United Latin American Citizens, Hearing Associates, Homes for Good Housing Agency, Jerry Detaum, architect, landscape architect, and special thanks to our in-kind sponsors, University of Oregon, Academic Extension, Dotson's Photography, and KRVM 91.9 Radio. Before we go to member questions, please remember to keep your questions short and to the point. Actually, today we have plenty of time, so we still don't want to hear your speech. We would rather hear from the mayor, but you have a little bit of leeway if you want to set up your questions. Okay, first question, please.
Hi. Hi, Lucy. Thank you for coming. Steve Robinson, charter City Club member and recent City Club member, both. I'm asking this question for a student at our table who wants to know, why is it that in order to qualify for subsidized housing, one must not go to college full-time for 5 months in a calendar year? Apparently that's a rule.
And I'm not the person with the knowledge to answer that rule. I don't know why that rule exists or what the reasoning, I mean, it's just beyond my expertise, but.
So there's a general question as to why is it that policies get, developed and rolled out in ways that sometimes are counter to what you might think they would be, there are considerations here and here and they wind up in conflict and for some reason they never get resolved.
Well, and housing really is a perfect example of that, and especially subsidized housing is a good example because these are public funds, and so criteria are established to identify the target audience and make sure that the funds are being used appropriately and serving the right population, and then those become sort of ossified, right? They become hard and fast targets. So then the providers are caught in this position where they can't, there's no flexibility around, there's no adaptability to those criteria because it's hard and fast. And so I do think that as much as it's concerning to witness the decline in federal dollars that are available for subsidized housing, on the upside, there is an advantage to having private support for that because it doesn't come with all those narrow federal constraints. And it is the experience that we're witnessing across the community, that people who should be eligible for that housing can't get into the housing or can't retain the housing. So that may be the little bit of a ray of hope, that as we have more private dollars, and when I worked at shelter care, this was one of the my roles as a development director was to keep those private dollars pumping in because it did give us a little more agility.
Thank you. Hi, Lucy. Beth Giroux, City Club member. And you mentioned the 1% tax that the council is considering putting on new construction. I wonder if you can say a little more about who would be taxed, who would be assessed, i.e., is it all new construction, or would there be a base level of construction before that would be applied, and then how and who will be administering the tax?
Right. So the proposal that came from the Housing Policy Board that the council is considering is a 1% tax on new construction. It's on the building permits themselves, on new construction, both commercial and residential. So there are different criteria around how those funds could then be spent after the fact. But it basically would be across the board permits for new construction or improvements of a certain dollar value. But that I cannot remember what that number is. Betty's in the audience; she may remember what that number is. But So it would be across the board. I think, the devil's in the details on these, and the details are not determined yet because council is still in this process of sort of assessing and hearing back from staff. At the missing middle form, it was very interesting because in Bend they chose to lower the tax so that it would be a lower amount because the statement from a statement from a home builder from Hayden Homes said every $1,000 you increase in the cost of a house drops out 250 potential purchasers of that house. And in Bend, they had opted for a one-third of 1%, so a much smaller rate, which for the average house only increased the cost by $500, which, you know, if you've bought a house and you know how many things get added on to that final purchase price, seems less onerous. So we're not at that point yet. And so stay tuned. I think there's a lot more detail to come.
Jerry, may I impose and ask a question that's related to this? Someone had asked whether the council discussed having a tax on real estate transactions rather than the tax on construction. Was that discussed?
We actually did not discuss that. I think we discussed the proposals as they came to us on the CET specifically.
Thank you.
Jerry Diethelm, City Club member. This is a similar question about housing that's affordable for the people, for example, living in Opportunity Village now, who are actually ready to move on, but they can't find anything that they can afford. So we know the problem. My neighbor and I were discussing this on our walk this morning. And the federal dollars, as you say, are declining. And the people who, you know, we are doing some good work in our community, St. Vincent and others, are filling the gap in some ways or other, but they still need to be financed. And the city probably isn't really the best group to do that kind of housing. So if it's not federal, then it's probably local, and a bigger local commitment for at least the interim until the federal is available again, needs to be channeled to some of those people like St. Vinny's and others who can really do that work. So we're talking about a funding stream or various kinds of funding streams, but isn't the first step the local commitment to put that money into the nonprofits so they can build some of this housing?
Absolutely, and the local commitment is already there. I mean, we have the city puts, you know, $900,000 a year into the Human Services Commission that goes to housing providers. You know, we've had various contracts with St. Vincent de Paul, so the commitment is there. I actually think this is the reason that the Poverty and Homelessness Board is so important, because so much of these services are really channeled through the county and coming from the state. So I think when we look at public dollars, we're looking at what the state can make available, and then we're looking at those priorities through the county. And the Poverty and Homelessness Board has established a target. They've established a target that in a five-year span, they want to increase the number of Housing First units by 600. And a lot of those folks who are ready to move out of Opportunity Village would be, you know, prime candidates for that Housing First model. And so HACS has got two of those on the books now. There's the one at MLK on MLK Boulevard, and then there's the one they're working on right on the Fifth Street Market. So there are a couple of those coming along. They're slow, and I think that when we're talking about this, and again talking about non-federal dollars, you know, that opportunity maybe work a little faster. I mean, there's also work, as you're probably familiar, there's a lot of work about on the building standards that we're requiring for the tiny homes in particular to make that a little more agile and responsive to the need. So we're kind of working at all those levels, realizing that, again, an Emerald Village, an Opportunity Village person could quickly go into a tiny home in Emerald Village, and that's the next step up, and then they're gaining some equity. So we're just trying to create all those rungs on the ladder so people can step their way up, and it's going to take all kinds of investment to do it.
Dina Wills, City Club member. Our table did agree, I believe, that anybody who's living on the street at this point in the weather is not a traveler, is not passing through, lives here, may have a job if that person is lucky. Our question was about the three things you talked about, homelessness and housing, which is unaffordable, and the police department. Somebody who's living in a place that's illegal because she can't find anything else, even though she has a job, and then gets picked up by the cops and given a fine she can't pay. What is the interaction among those three things that you talked about?
Right. It's a perfect question. I mean, we are in a position in which we are penalizing people who actually have no recourse. There's no place for them to go, and it's cold, and we're, you know, leveling fines on them. And so this is not the place that any of us want to be. It's not what the police want to do. It's not what the social service providers want. It's not what we as a community want, because it's merciless. It's merciless. It's not how we see ourselves. And I think the challenge we have is where do we want people to sleep and how do we want to do that? Because we also have a responsibility as a community to enable people to feel that their own property is safe. And so there are challenges. If you're a downtown business and people are sleeping in your storefront or sleeping in the back, I mean, you know, as a city, we have some responsibility to protect all citizens. And it is, you know, what I say about this is that our goal is to create more legal places for people to sleep. And the challenge is, where are those and what do they look like and who oversees that and how do we make sure they're safe? And, you know, anybody who's got a brilliant idea about this, please step up, because we're just struggling with it, right? We have all these different pieces, the dusk to dawn, the rest stops, we keep trying. We're talking about a permanent shelter, so hopefully that'll get built in a couple of years, and we'll have that, and then we'll have that recourse. But it's right now, we just don't really have enough answers.
Sue Walling, City Club member. Eugene is a city that thrives on the process of civic engagement, and that's a wonderful thing. I mean, that's the whole point of places like the City Club. But a lot of the time, our process just drags on, and it becomes even more divisive, so that in the end, anyone who doesn't get what they originally wanted feels like they weren't heard. And I was just wondering what ideas you have for how we can use our civic engagement processes to find action and solutions and learn to compromise and accept that it was a good process. I didn't get everything I wanted, but it's what the community decided, so let's move on.
Well, that's the challenge. That's the challenge. I mean, you know, we want people to speak their minds. And, you know, the good news, I think, when we see what happens in the public forums in front of the city council is that Bob Cassidy and I were talking about this before the meeting, that people come, they come very well prepared, they're ready to speak in their three-minute time, and really it's respectful, it's thoughtful, and there's a really excellent public discourse. So that means a lot to the city council. We really pay attention to what happens in that public forum. So I think that's the healthy side of it. I think with all issues that we would all agree that there are times when you just sort of think, oh, enough already. We've talked about this enough. Can we just move to action? And I certainly think that with the three issues that the council is talking about this year, housing, homelessness, and poverty, that those are all enough already, right? We've talked about this enough. Let's begin to go from talking to doing. And so I do think we want to this year set ourselves some outcomes. Like, what do we think is a successful outcome for the next year or 18 months worth of work on this issue? So it's not it's just sort of a constant revolving door of discussions, but we've actually dialed in on something. And I will say one other thing, and the missing middle is an excellent example of this, which is it takes all three legs of the stool. It takes healthy public engagement. It takes good staff work in the city of Eugene to support an issue, and it takes political will in the council. And you can't get anything done in this community without all three of those members of the partnership working well together. So we know when it gets derailed. You know, we know when we've had a public process and the public feels that they didn't get a chance to speak. We know what it feels like when we think we've had a robust public process and someone comes in at the 11th hour and says, wait a second, you didn't listen to me. So, and we also know when the staff presentation is not adequate or when council does not speak with one voice and does not have the will to do what we want. So to me, that's the work. It's the way you all contribute to that work, is that having that really deliberative process and supporting council, which needs to know that you're on board to do this work.
I'm Robin Fletcher, and I've been a member since 2004. And my question is about the missing middle more, I think. That we have some wonderful nonprofits that do amazing work, very active. But what's going to motivate new construction buildings and construction companies to build affordable housing instead of high-end housing? The post-World War II, there was a huge push for that inexpensive housing, which many of us live in now. But where are those going to come from and why?
Right. That is the question. And that so the Missing Middle Forum last week was very powerful because all of the players came into the room. So we had developers, we had builders, we had realtors, all in the room. Because at the end of the day, this is not something, we're not going to build our way out of the housing crisis if we are relying on Cornerstone Community Housing in St. Vinny's. I mean, that's not going to do it. It's not going to be fast enough or big enough. They can't do it. And that was one of the points that the presenters made at the forum last week. It is going to be some public-private partnership. And so the burden is on us as a public and the city council and city staff to identify those ways in which we can remove barriers and make it economically viable for someone to build this housing and, you know, recoup their investment on building that housing. And so I think that's the work ahead of us this year is, you know, hopefully sooner than later, but starting to build that kind of short list of what are the things that we know we can do. And it, you know, we're immediately already in this conversation about secondary dwelling units, and they've been allowable in the city of Eugene, but not built in the way we want, because we know we have some code challenges that make that harder. So those are the conversations. How do we make it viable?
Sandy Erickson, City Club member. Addressing the barriers, one of the most persistent and I think universal barriers and it always comes about when housing prices rise, is the pronounced effect of NIMBYism. Mm-hmm. It's socially and psychologically decipherable. It's teachable. It's something that can be understood and identified and studied uniquely for what it is. And so my question is, what's the city doing about that specifically?
Right. Well, again, I just talked about the three key partners. There's the city council having the will, there's the staff doing good staff work, and then there's the public. And again, to talk about the missing middle form, that was really the point of that missing middle form, is saying what will it take for neighbors and neighborhoods to feel that they can flex a little bit on how this looks? And in the best of all possible worlds, in the best scenario, we reduce the barriers to missing middle housing, and the housing types that we build integrate into those neighborhoods. So I think about this. I think about those of us in the room, we're all boomers, pretty much. And so when we think about the housing we live in, there are many of us who would consider the possibility of either having a secondary dwelling unit or converting a single family home into a duplex. So you're not changing the footprint in the neighborhood, you're not changing the impact on the neighborhood, but you have suddenly doubled the number of households that can live on that property. I think that's the thinking behind the missing middle, is that it can lower everybody's blood pressure around, you know, we're ruining the neighborhoods, that it gives us an opportunity. And we do have neighborhoods, Jefferson West Side being the premium example, that has lots and lots of missing middle housing. And I bet that most of us, when we drive through there, it doesn't catch our eye in any way. We're so used to it, the footprint is just like all the other housing, and you don't sort of identify, oh, that's a fourplex, or that's a duplex, or that's a small apartment building. You just don't even notice. So I think that's the goal, and I think it's that constant reiteration of there's a way of doing it. We have the benefit of working with the River Road Santa Clara planning process, and they're quite open to that. So they offer us this opportunity of a neighborhood that's willing to sort of integrate this, front load this into sort of the thinking about how they look at their neighborhood planning. That's a huge advantage for us as a city, that we have a neighborhood that's sort of poised to have that conversation. So a success there, I think, starts to open the doors in other neighborhoods.
Just a footnote, this is Sandra Bishop, City Club member. For some of the non-boomers or people who are new to town who are here today, NIMBY stands for?
Not in my backyard.
Dave Pedanke, City Club member. I have a two-part question about the interface between local police and the current decision that's upcoming about the Eugene police chief and federal immigration enforcement. And I want to applaud the city's process so far in terms of reaching out in the community to get public input about the police chief search process, and wanted to remind people that there's going to be a community forum on March 13th at 5:30 at Harris Hall, where people can ask questions of the three finalists, all of whom are coming from out of state. And as you know, Oregon has a strong law that limits involvement by state and local police in federal immigration enforcement, which has been categorized as a so-called sanctuary law. It's really not. So I wanted you to comment on the importance of that law and the ordinance that City Council passed a year ago, and also on what your counterpart in Oakland did recently to make a public announcement that there was a massive ICE roundup in the works. Would you do something like that if you heard about it?
I'm gonna start with the end last of that question first, because I would, and I thought it was phenomenal. I thought, oh, am I actually positioned? Do I have the kind of the understanding of the city government? Am I there? Would I do that? Do I know to do that? But I would do it given that opportunity and given that moment in time. And I think that's a very important statement for our community. I mean, the The significance of the city's ordinance last year is profound because we wanted first to send a message and provide clarity for our city departments, what we would do and what we wouldn't do, and draw a very clear line about what federal agents cannot expect us on a local level to implement immigration law. It is not our role in the nation, and we will not use local resources to do that. We have had a state law on the books since 1986, and the concern, and this is beginning to happen, is that there is a movement to repeal that state law. So we've had a state sort of sanctuary law all along saying local law enforcement cannot be used to implement immigration policy and immigration rules. And, if that's chipped away at the state level, we want to make sure it's still hard and fast at the local level and that we won't be doing that. So I will say that every day I wake up and I am grateful to be a mayor in Oregon, because I feel like the state legislature and the governor has our back, and we're not out there all alone. And how horrifying it would be, actually, to be a mayor in some of the states where the leadership at the state level does not have your back. So I feel supported in that protection of our immigrant community, of the newcomers to our community, and committed to those policies that we ensure that there's a very clear line between what our job is as a municipality and that it is not involved in identifying and helping the immigration authorities round people up and deport them.
Hey, James Barber, Springfield City Club member. Just a quick note about the quote you used earlier. I wonder if we would have succeeded as a species if we didn't inherently believe that we live in the most pivotal time in history. and the question. I really appreciate the work you've done on the Poverty and Homelessness Board, and specifically when you set up a series of meetings to go out and actually meet with the homeless in the community. I'm wondering if there's any specific programs or solutions that came out of those meetings.
That's a great question, and reminds me that I'm due to have another one of those meetings. The most interesting piece that came out of that was that when we had a kind of a mayor's town hall in Alton Baker Park with the folks who are sleeping in Alton Baker Park, and there were two issues that were of key concern, and one was where they store their belongings and keeping them dry, and the second one was garbage. And so the short-term decision was on the garbage, which is that we had a whole volunteer group that got together that was supporting the Parks and Open Space. So our Parks and Open Space staff actually will provide homeless campers with rubber gloves and garbage bags to manage their own belongings, and if they're willing to help collect garbage in the park. And a lot of those campers will do that. And so the goal was to sort of support that effort and make it a little bit more robust. And so there was a volunteer network that were sort of augmenting the garbage pickup that Parks and Open Space already does, because they're constrained in terms of staff time and funding to do as much. So part of the new parks levy would, add a little more support to that, because really that's a city job. I mean, we really shouldn't be requiring volunteers to pick up garbage. We should really be able to manage our garbage. So part of that is to help us have a little more robust garbage pickup, so that we're just modifying or mediating the impact of homeless campers in those public spaces. The other piece, the storage of personal items, I am still frustrated in that goal, and it still is a high priority of mine. I'm hoping that we'll make some progress towards a day shelter. We just really, I had this idea, it didn't go anywhere, so I'm still thinking about it. I know that in, I think it's in one of the California cities, I can't remember, they use actually the kind of recycle bins, plastic bins, and they issue them to the homeless campers, and so they can store their things in there during the day, and it's locked up. And I thought we could come up with a system like that. We haven't sort of identified where that would happen and who's going to manage it, but I do think there's a faster, quicker, cheaper way of helping people, and I think, I imagine that all of you are periodically buying socks and buying sleeping bags and buying winter coats for folks who are living out of doors. And, you know, the terrible thing is you give someone a new sleeping bag and it rains that night, and the next day that person is compelled to just leave it on the ground because it's sodden and wet and heavy and they can't haul it around anymore. So we're our own worst enemies if we don't just sort of come up with a better system so people can keep their stuff dry and get it dry, and short of having a good shelter for them, at least, you know, we need to help it along the way. So it's a work in progress, incomplete, and thank you for reminding me about it.
Lou Powell, City Club member. This question is not about the homeless or housing. In the upcoming election, we're going to be presented with two very similar but competing measures around auditors. Can you help us understand city government's objection to an elected auditor?
Yes. Yes, I can. So I wouldn't say that city government has objected to an elected auditor. I would say that the city council felt that there was an alternative that had been proposed in the 2002 Charter Review Committee that has been used by Lane County, and that we should also consider it. And so the importance here is that there are communities all over the country who have auditors. And I personally campaigned on the idea that we should have an auditor. It was an issue in the Ward 1 race, totally supportive of the idea of an auditor. And when I was first approached about the initiative that has become Measure 2283, I said, you know, I'm totally on board with the idea of an auditor. I am unpersuaded that an elected auditor is the way to go in our community. And I'm still unpersuaded. And I think the challenge here is that in this case, we have if this ballot measure passes in May, those candidates will file for a November election. I ran a citywide election, and it took me a year and a half, and I had to raise over $100,000 to do it. So my concern is that 6 months is not a very long time for a new person to come into this community from wherever and run an effective campaign where you as the public really get to know what are their credentials, are they qualified to do this. And then on top of that, there is no runoff. So we have one candidate, that candidate wins. We have five candidates, the candidate who gets, you know, 23% of the vote could win. So my concern is whether it's an adequate vetting process, whether we're having an opportunity to actually vet the qualifications of the candidate. And so I think, I think that compare and contrast is a time-honored pedagogic technique. It is the way we compel ourselves to go through a process of discernment on any issue. So I think it's valuable to say, for the community to say, this is what an elected auditor structure could be, this is what an appointed auditor structure could be. You decide. You're able to decide. And whatever auditor position happens, we own it as the public. So let's make sure we know what we're buying. That's my only point. So I think elected auditors work in many communities, and I'm not on the face of it opposed to an elected auditor, but I am worried about the way it is structured and will play out in this particular case because of the timeline.
Thank you. This is Sandra Bishop, City Club member. There's another question that was posed to me on the way to the forum today, and it has to do with public safety. It's our understanding, of course, that the City Council is sharing the chambers with the Lane County Commission, and this week there was some sort of credible threat, and so that the security was beefed up at the Lane County Commissioners meetings. So do you expect that to affect the council meetings in the chamber?
No, they're protecting the county, but they're not protecting the city. So
all right.
Our meetings proceeded as normal, and I would expect they will continue to proceed as normal.
All right, great. Thank you very much. Mayor, we have a few more minutes if there are any other wrap-up remarks or things that you would like to get on the record. Go ahead. Right ahead.
You know, I think I would take 1 minute to sort of wrap up the first comment and the last comment and say, One of my views about this discussion about the auditor, as with anything, is that there's good news and there's bad news. And the good news is that we're having a constructive, thorough discussion of what this auditor role should be, what it should look like, and what's important to us as a community. It's an important public policy decision. I am happy to see it on the front page of the newspaper and on the guest viewpoint and letters to the editor on the back. That is an incredibly important public process. It should be happening. The bad news, to go back to the beginning, is when that conversation is dismissive or scornful or, you know, unnecessarily personal, it's not helpful to the conversation. And I think we see that across the board in public discourse. And so, you know, I guess I ask all of you to hold ourselves to the standard that we hold in our public forums as a city council, which is prepare your thoughts, deliver them respectfully and thoroughly, and then we will have an excellent, robust, serious public conversation, and just as you all do here at the City Club. So that's my wish for all of us on all of these very, very gnarly public policy issues, whether we are talking about housing or homelessness or police services or the structure of our city government. So thank you all for your contribution to that conversation.
Thank you. Before we thank our speaker, there are a few announcements. We want to thank public radio station KLCC 89.7 for airing City Club programs on Monday at 6:30 following the Friday program. And thank you to Community Television of Lane County, Cable Channel 29, for televising recent City Club programs. Next week, Friday, March 9th, please join us for a presentation on earthquake preparedness, getting ready for the big one. More detail on this and other programs can be found online at City Club's website, cityclubofeugene.org. And we'd really like to give a big round of applause to Mayor Lucy Vinnis. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, and that concludes today's program.